Thanks for downloading this podcast, which is for personal use only. All contents are copyright Radio Show Limited and must not be reproduced, rebroadcast, or used in any form without permission. For contact details, go to www.radiolemon.com. RadioLeMans.com.
Hello there, and welcome to another Radio Le Mans Long One. And the subject for this interview is a good friend of the radio station and a personal friend of mine. I'm delighted to say we're at home with Johnny Morelam, who's having a little work done on Morelam Towers at the moment. So if you hear any banging, crashing or drilling in the background, please worry not, dear listener. Johnny, welcome to the programme. We're going to go back right to the very start of your motor racing career. Most people that I talk to for those interviews, for these interviews, started off at a very early age in karting. Not the case for one Jay Morelam Esquire.
Well, hi, John. It's great that great to welcome you to my house. We're having a West Wing put on. But no, you're right. I'm almost a bit of a, in a funny way, because I'm really into drivers in the motorsport history of the drivers. I've never been one of those drivers that could name you, you know, the exact cubic capacity of every car that's raced or every car that I've raced. But I am really into the history of the drivers. And funnily enough, one of the reasons I got into motorsport and wanted to have a go at it myself was through reading Nigel Roebuck's Grand Prix Greats and reading about the drivers and their personalities and all the rest of it. And it fascinated me. And I guess in some ways, sitting here now thinking about it, I'm a bit of a throwback to an era when all drivers started a lot later, you know, the sort of, I guess, going right back to the Stirling Mosses, who at the time was considered to be extremely young. And I believe he was in his late teens or early 20s. Even Jackie Stewart, he was considered to be young in his late teens, early 20s. And it was the same for me. I didn't actually sit my derriere into a racing car until I was probably 19 at the Brands Hatch Racing School in a Formula First.
So what were you doing before that, and where was Johnny Morelam's life path going before that momentous day that you sat in a Formula First?
Well, that's a really good question, because I was at the age of 16, 17, didn't really have a clue what I was doing. I was brought up in Mallorca in Spain, initially Spanish system, and then switched. My parents decided to put me into an international school, so I ended up doing the American and the English system, so like O-levels or GCSEs, as they call them now, and then A-levels, always with a view to going to university. It was kind of just, that was one of the things that was always going to happen. And when I was 16, 17, I took my A-levels a little bit early, and then I was going to come to British University. And at that summer, before coming to university, a friend of mine, who actually ended up going on to race a little bit himself in this country and in Italian F3, called Sebastian Mordillo, who's actually the son of Guillermo Mordillo, the humorist cartoonist, he had a go-kart, like a proper kart, and I had a go on it just one summer, and absolutely just hooked me. And up until then, I'd always been into motorsport and always loved watching it. I'd loved Muscle-Electric. I remember, and this is something I really want to try and achieve, is I remember hearing, and I can only be about 2 or 3 years old, because before we moved, I moved out to Spain when I was about three, and we used to live in Crystal Palace in Sydenham. And I can remember saying to my mother, I used to remember hearing car noises and everything. And my mother saying to me, oh, it must have been on a Sunday, you could hear the racing. And obviously it would have been at Crystal Palace. Yeah. So we're talking sort of 70, 71, something like that. And so I had it. I don't know if I had it in me and it was always there, just bursting to get out. But my father couldn't even drive a car, didn't have a driving license. My mother, you know, drove us everywhere. There was no real background. I didn't have anyone that was into motorsport in any sense. So it was difficult for me to sort of try and see a path into breaking into it.
You were sporty, though, and so you were competitive. Very, very good soccer player. Very good football, association football player. And played to a very good level when you were out in the Balearics.
Well, yeah, I was fortunate enough to be part of the Real Mallorca youth team, who at the time, to be fair, were actually in the what is now the equivalent of the second division over there. And so, but I played with some good players who went on to be professional. It was what I wanted to do, to be honest. That was my dream when I was 13, 14, 15, to be a professional football player. But then I had a really, really bad injury, right knee injury. And when you're sort of 15 and a half going on 16 at that age, you're not valuable enough to anyone to start. And also back in the day, and we're talking quite a while ago, when You know, when you tear ligaments and rip cartilages, they just kind of write you off. In fact, I was told I'd never play again, like not even a kick around, but I actually still managed that. So things have worked out there. But when I did this, going back to the karting, when I had to go on that, I got such an exhilaration from it that I suddenly thought, and for some reason, I went quicker than Sebastian had gone on it, you know, and he'd been going around all day in about 10 laps. And the guy came out that ran the circuit and said, oh, you're doing quite well there, and gave me a few pointers. Like, I was basically overdriving it and being too much steering input and all the rest of it. And I suddenly thought, God, I want to do this. And I don't know what happened, but a little thing, maybe it was waiting there all my life, but it just flicked in my head. And I just thought, I'm not going to not go to university. That would be stupid. I'm going to go to university, but I'm going to spend the next 2-3 years working out how I can get into motorsport. And while I was at university, I joined the karting club at university. I literally never even raced it because we spent the entire time trying to fix this blooming go-kart. And the only time we got it working, it was me and one other guy. So it wasn't exactly a big karting club. This was at Leeds University. The only time we got it working, literally my mate drove it up and down the car park and it broke again. So I never even got on this blooming go-kart. But I decided, a very unfortunate thing happened while I was at uni. And my father and my grandfather actually died within a week of each other, unrelated. And which was, as you can imagine, at the age of 17, was a huge... huge blow. But the silver lining from that was that my grandfather left me a little bit of money, and we're talking a little bit of money. It was like, I don't mind saying, it was about £60,000, which I guess to some people is not a little bit of money, and back then in the sort of mid to late 80s was a lot more. But I thought, right, I'm going to use this, I'm going to graduate, and then I'm going to take that money and I'm going to try and go racing with it.
And you graduated in what from Leeds University?
I actually did a joint honours degree in economics and Spanish. I'm actually a Bachelor of Arts joint honours. Yeah, I know.
Smarty pants.
In those days, it was less, you know, now everyone goes to university. In those days, less people went to university. I think some people say to me, well, that was a waste of time. I don't think anything in the sense of, I think if I'd gone straight into racing at that point then, in some ways, I wouldn't have been able to do as well as I have now, because the one thing I had going for me was, even though I was a lot older, probably at that, and don't forget, back then I was a bit older. Now I'd be like 10 years older than everyone else. Back then I was about 4 or 5 years older than most people getting into the racing scene. But the one advantage I had was I was able to go into a boardroom of directors or companies or whatever. And obviously, I wouldn't say I was brilliant from the get-go, but I was reasonably switched on. I could put a proposal together and I could sell myself and sell what I was trying to achieve. And that I wouldn't have had that if I hadn't been to university and had to stand up and deliver dissertations and all the rest of it.
So you have a little bit of money from your inheritance and you've decided that you've got to use some, possibly all of that money, to try and further motorsport. At that point, Johnny, did you even have any idea of where that might take you, about how much more you might need? Because let's be honest, in motor racing, £60,000, even in those days, is a drop in the ocean. Did you have any concept of what you were getting yourself in for?
I had no idea whatsoever, and I think that naivety helped me, because if I'd known now what I known then what I know now, I wouldn't have probably even attempted to start. And back then I just thought, if you were quick and you did well, you didn't, you know, you'd have a year of doing well. I had an understanding. I used to watch the Formula Ford Festival on television when I was at uni and stuff, and I didn't really know whether those drivers were getting paid to be there or how it worked. I didn't really understand the concept of taking money to a team, but I had a sort of inkling that maybe at the beginning, obviously no one's going to pay you because what have you done? You're a complete beginner. But I didn't understand quite how much money played a part in getting yourself up the totem pole of motorsport. And I just went to Brands Hatch, where I was doing I enrolled to do the race school at Brands Hatch. And I talked to John Webb, and just said, I'd like to get into racing. And he probably heard it from 100 kids every day. And he just gave me the name of 3 or 4 people to give a call. One of them was Tony Trimmer, who I remember, who I then later on met. And another one was Eldon Racing Cars, a guy called Brian Hampshire. And I went to see Brian and hit it off with him. He was a complete flake, but I really liked him. And he said to me, if you come to Eldon and pay us £15,000... we will pay, we will, you can work for us, you can work on the cars, we'll pay you £100 a week, which back then was enough just about to live. We're talking £5,000 a year. And in your spare time, you can work on your own car, and we will provide you with a Formula First that they had there, and you can do 5 or 6 races in the Formula First. So I thought, great, I've started. And I stayed with Eldon for nearly a year and a half, 2 years doing that. And
so that, valuable, I would think, because of your lack of automotive or motoring or motorsport background, you learned that then from a mechanical side. So the mechanical side of things was something that you probably had no inkling of whatsoever.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if I could do it now, but there was a time when I could put a Formula Ford 16 engine together, you know, and Glenn Searle round the corner, Searle Engines, I don't know if they still exist, he taught me how to do it. And I basically, with him looking over my shoulder, I did all my own rebuilds of my engines. We built a Formula Ford 1600. I was welding my own chassis. You know, it was really good. You know, lock wire. I was constantly sticking lock wire through my fingers. I remember that. Jeez, that was so painful. But it was good for me because I really did learn not just the sort of basic mechanics of a racing car, but I also learnt how motorsport works. And I began to realise the importance of money. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't go anywhere else because nobody, I mean, that deal, looking back, even then, that deal was an amazing deal they offered me. They must have had, you know, felt sorry for me or something. And it allowed me to do a bit of testing. And I ended up racing in their Formula 4, which was useless, the Eldon Formula 4. But I can vividly remember the moment, because I didn't know if I was any good. And I kept on going quicker than various people in the car, but I didn't really think much of them. And there was a guy called Andrew Stapley, who was a Champion of Brands driver, who at the time was winning Champion of Brands races, who used to race for Ray, Bert Ray's cars, which have now gone on to do great things. And he got in my car and did 10 laps at Brands Hatch, and he was about 4 or 5 tenths slower than I was. And I can remember that day vividly because I went home so excited, because I actually thought, maybe I am good enough to do this. And then I ended up, the next big break was I convinced my mum to buy me a Reynard, 89 Reynard, which I think was about £9,000 or something, which again, you know, and she bought that for me because I didn't have, people think because of the Molan background, you know, John Molan construction and all the rest of it, that I had, you know, a silver spoon and everything. But I didn't have money behind me from, obviously I had a bit more than maybe average person. I had someone like my mum, basically the most that ever happened was that my grandfather, I inherited that money and my mum bought me my first racing car. And then I did the Formula Ford Festival. I did some races in the rain. I did the Formula Ford Festival at the end of 89 and got to the final and then finished, I think, 18th or 19th in the final. In one of the heats, I think I was fourth and David Coulthard won it. So I thought, well, that's not too bad. And I was actually in a car for the first time that was decent. And I sold that, got myself a Van Diemen RF90 for the following year and began to get a deal off Van Diemen because I think people were seeing that I was able to do something. And then started racing in the National Junior Dunlop Autosport Star of Tomorrow. And at that time, Warren Hughes was racing and cleaning up on everything. But I was, you know, I qualified. I had a pole position, qualified in the front row, did well.
And were you still financing this from either, you know, your mum, your family, working? There was no sponsorship on the car at this point?
No, there was no sponsorship. I hadn't found a sponsor because I was only 2 years in, really, at that point, and beginning to work it all out. I was still eking out the money that I'd got from my grandfather, so I was making that £60,000 go a long way. And I didn't do the whole Dunlop Autosport Star at the National Championship, but I did selected rounds. I did Champion of Brands. I finished third in Champion of Brands and won 4 or 5 races that year against people like Dave Germain, who obviously was coming back down from F3. And I was one of the quickest there. Pedro de la Rosa, I used to consistently run, you know, in fact, to be honest, we used to consistently beat Pedro de la Rosa, but he was a really good driver that we, you know. And that's when I began to believe in myself a little bit, probably not as much as I should have done, but a little bit. And that, at the end of 1990, I was actually selected or nominated for the McLaren Autosport Young Driver of the Year, but didn't make the final because at that point, I was by 1 month too old.
Despite the fact that you had probably the least experience of anybody who would have been there.
Absolutely, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. And that was the year Gareth Rees won it. And then that was when I kind of went off a little bit because I thought, right, I've done Formula 4, done quite well. Mm-hmm. I actually had an offer from Swift, Frank Bradley, to have a factory deal with Swift. It involved taking a very small amount of money. And I decided, nope, I'm going to step up to Vauxhall Lotus, which in retrospect was the biggest. I've made a few whoppers in my career of decisions, but that was a bad decision.
That was a fairly new championship at that time. We'll talk about that in a minute. In those 2 years, did you have some of the naivety knocked out of you? And I suggest you probably did. How big was the shock of the shark pool that you dropped yourself into? You'd been on the fringes of professional sport before, so your eyes weren't completely shut. But how big was the shock when you saw what motorsport was really about?
I didn't really find out until I went into Vauxhall Lotus, right. Because then I ran with Howard Drake Automotive, mm-hmm. in Formula Ford, who'd run Pete Rogers, who was a fantastic driver, unfortunately got killed at Donington in a Formula Ford, one of the last people I think ever to get killed in a Formula Ford. And it was very much a family team, family atmosphere. Champion of Brands was, you know, a great championship, mm-hmm. back then, and you had all the big guys coming whenever there was a race at Brands, like Dave Coyne and, mm. you know, Nico Polaris and, you know, Gilles de Ferran and Bernard Dolan. They'd all come and race in our championship just to get time, especially when the festival was approaching. So it was a great, really strong championship, but it was still Champion of Brands. And the national stuff I did was when I began to realise, you know, going up against people like Jonathan Lewis, and you suddenly realise, you know, Jonathan Lewis, you know, takes no prisoners. People started playing mental games with me, and at that time mentally I was incredibly fragile, mm-hmm. because I had no experience, so I was putting a huge pressure on myself, because I thought if I didn't qualify on at least the front row and didn't run in the top two or three in the race, it meant I was rubbish, mm-hmm. and I didn't understand, you know, how to get my head around that. So if I wasn't doing that, I would try and win the race literally on the first lap. If I wasn't leading on the first lap, I would try and take the lead on the first lap. And the number of shunts I had, and I can remember Howard Drake despairing of me, saying, you know, show some patience, you know, you can't be out there leading every lap of every... But I didn't understand, because I'd read all these books of Nigel Roebuck's, of Grand Prix greats. At that point, I wanted to be a Formula One driver. That was my dream. Right. And I'd read all this, you know, about Gilles Villeneuve and everything. Of course, now I know, but I didn't understand then the artistic license that people like Nigel Roebuck will take, in terms of, you know, you only look at the best bits of a career. So you don't realise that every driver out there, even a Lewis Hamilton or something like that, they've had moments in their career where they've struggled. And I thought, if I'm struggling, that means I'm no good.
Yeah.
And so I put too much pressure on myself.
We need to put this in context, because jumping up from Formula 4 to Formula Vauxhall Lotus, from the outside, the cars look pretty similar. Vauxhall Lotus.
Oh,
I'll
tell you a funny story about that in a minute.
it was a brand new championship.
Yeah, they were very slippery, but to me, it looked like a monster. It looked like a Formula One car to me when I first got in one. And I drove out, never driven slicks before in my life, because I'd never done karting.
Right.
And obviously, Formula 4 1600 back then was treaded tyres. Yeah. I went out the pits at Silverstone, my first time ever in the car, absolutely bricking it. And I went out and I got out of the pit lane in a straight line. And I thought, oh, I'll just put my foot down here and just see what I've got. Cold tyres, put my foot down, lost it, buried it in the barrier on the left-hand side. Yeah. So I literally must have gone 150 metres on the track. My first time ever in a Vauxhall Lotus, stuck it in the fence, and fortunately just damaged the nose cone a little bit. But that's when I suddenly thought, oh, Christ, what have I done? You know what? But I was running myself then by literally paying a mechanic. Tom, his name was. I don't know if he was still alive, about 65 back then. I paid him 60 quid. A day, mm-hmm. to come a mechanic for me, and I think this is how, in a way, I got taken pity on almost by Jackie Stewart, because he saw me, or if he didn't actually physically see me, he was made aware of the fact that I was rocking up to races in literally with my Volkswagen 1.1 Golf, mm-hmm. with a trailer on the back, with my racing car on it.
How the hell did you tour a racing car, which is kind of like an F3, if you're thinking about, that's kind of what it looks like, and the performance is not far off in those days what an F3 would have been. Twin cam Vauxhall engine, 2 litre engine, for a decent amount of power, I seem to remember. How did you manage to pull that in your kit with a 1.1?
Well, I tell you what I learnt very early on is you have to reverse the car up onto the trailer, because if you run it with the front nose to the back and the engine at the back of the trailer, you get a situation where the thing snakes across the motorway to the point that you can barely control it. So I learned that very quickly. But no, I was rocking up there, and I can remember in one test session, I was literally there on my own because Tom hadn't arrived. Mm-hmm. And I was going out there, running around, getting out of my own car, coming in the pits, taking my own tire pressures, mm-hmm. getting back in, belting myself back in, and going back out again. And it was really motorsport done differently back then. And yeah. I'm going to sound ancient now, but I've been doing this 22 years, and I can remember the moment that Toka happens. Mm-hmm. And I can remember being told by Jenny Birrell, mm-hmm. you know, in a very nice way, that I wouldn't be able to race the following season in Vauxhall Lotus because it was going to be part of the Toka package. And to be part of it, you need to have your own truck. Mm-hmm. with an awning, mm-hmm. and it was all going to be with BTCC, mm-hmm. and you couldn't do what I was doing. They you know, it was too clubby, you know.
The last time I saw anything like that happen was the advent of Formula BMW.
Yeah.
And right at the very start of Formula BMW, which was on the British Touring Car Package as well, there were one or two people, including Ashley, the lad who won it, who turned up with a transit van and a trailer and ran it with his dad.
Yeah.
And I thought, we're not going to say that again.
No.
And you won't say that again. As you say, different days. You're listening to The Long One on RadioLeMans.com. It's Johnny Morelam who's with me, John Hindorf, today. We're at Johnny's house, as you can hear. There's a bit of building work going on in the background, but Johnny's been kind enough to get the cup of coffee on, and we're sitting here discussing Johnny's early career. And so we're up to Formula Vauxhall Lotus. Slicks, bit of wings, proper looking racing car, fast racing car. You have said, oh, Jackie Stewart must have taken pity on me. But in fairness, for whatever else you didn't have, what you did have was pace. And when you were out on the track, you were putting decent times in and you were getting results.
Well, I wasn't getting, I mean, for what the way I was running it, I think I was getting half decent results. I mean, I was never running around last, but I was never, I think the best I ever finished was fifth or sixth. I was never right at the front. Most of the time, I was somewhere between 7th and 10th is where I would finish. I never did the full championship. I did sort of 91, 92. I ended up having a big accident at Dingle Dell in 92 in testing and broke my wrist, which curtailed that. But I was running out of money, basically. My grandfather's money basically was running out. I'd found a few small personal sponsors at this point. I found Lowndes Lambert Insurance Company, gone to see them, and they were putting like 60, 70 grand in, which to me was a hell of a lot of money. Mm. But it still wasn't enough really to run things properly.
And well, you were spending that on the car. That wasn't a wage.
Oh God, that wasn't. The only way I was making money was working at Brands Hatch as a race instructor. I started there in 1990 and worked there for nearly 13, 14 years maybe. Mm. But yeah, going back to the Vauxhall Lotuses, I was doing okay. And then at the very end of 92, I was trying to ingratiate myself with some of the other mm-hmm. teams. And obviously at that time, Paul Stewart Racing was the team to be with. And
well, they actually changed the face of national racing at that level, didn't they? Because it was just, I remember when it happened, it was another level. It was a level of professionalism that we take for granted nowadays in pretty much everything that we see if there's a career path involved in it. But those days, that was another world.
It was, and you're right. They were the sort of forerunners for all of that, and Jackie was incredibly clever at that, and he basically saw an opportunity to get corporate sponsorship in at the highest level, Formula 3000, because he had a Formula 3000 team, a Formula 3 team, and then a Formula Vauxhall Lotus team, and bring the sponsorship down, bleed it all the way down. So
the staircase of talent, as he famously said.
Staircase of talent, but also the sponsorship was a staircase as well. Mm. And he was very clever like that, and I learned a lot from Jackie. In fact, I owe Jackie an awful lot, and he was good to me then, and he's been incredibly good to me since. But I can remember,
how did he get in touch? Come on. What happened? Because that, you know, Jackie Stewart, whether it's him personally or somebody of his entourage, gets in touch with you, a struggling racing driver, and struggling in every sense of the word. How does that happen, and how does that feel when it does happen?
Well, I'll try and tell you as quickly as I can, I'll tell you the whole story. Essentially, at the end of 92, I got asked, Mark Julian, who was the team manager of the Vauxhall Lotus team at that time, rang me up and asked me if I'd like to do a test. And I've been pushing to do a test. So it wasn't like he rang me up out of the blue.
Okay.
And he said, you're going to have to insure the car. It's 350 quid to insure the car. Now, 350 quid, I didn't have 350 quid at that point. But I somehow scraped that together. I can't even remember how I did it, to be honest. And I insured the car. I think I actually got the insurance company to cut me a deal. And Mike Eagles, who's also been a very good supporter of mine over the years. So I went and tested the car. And unfortunately then, Dario wasn't there. Yeah. And it was, the track was kind of wet. It never really dried up. And I can't remember what other which other drivers were there. I think it might have been Ellen Colby and somebody like that. And somebody else. And anyway, I ended up quicker than them, comfortably. But I don't think the team really knew how quick I was going, because it wasn't a day where you could do quick times and whatever. And they said, there's a chance maybe of a drive, but it'll be like £70,000-£75,000, which, to be honest, I knew I couldn't raise. And and I knew Jamie Davis was interested in looking at it.
So that would have been for a drive the following season, but still in Vauxhall Lotus?
Yeah, in 1990, that would have been looking at the 1993 season, right, which Dario Franchitti, who'd won the McLaren Young Driver of the Year at the end of 92, was going to be their lead driver. So I knew that the money they were asking at that point, I just kind of had a feeling this wasn't going to happen. So I went to a guy called Mick Goldney, who was running Jan Magnussen at Foundation Racing. And I said to him, look, can I do you a deal? I can't bring my car on the back of a trailer anymore. I own my own Vauxhall Lotus, because basically every time I'd driven, I'd sold a car. I was kind of being a secondhand car dealer, but with race cars. So I, you know, stick a bit of extra in, but kind of upgrade each time. And it wasn't costing me that much to upgrade, because I was getting secondhand cars all the time. And he said to me, yeah, I did a deal with him where I think I was going to pay him virtually nothing, but it would look good for him because it was like a two-car team.
Yes.
Still pay my mechanic, Tom, to come and run it for me, but we'd run it out of his truck, awning. His awning, and it would look like a two-car team. And I was actually testing with Jan at SNET, and of course, at that point, Jan Magnussen was a superstar, you know, and still is, to be fair.
Anybody that looks at Kevin now think that, but, I mean, all of that and some more, the next big thing was Jan.
Yeah, Jan had just won the festival. Yeah. This is prior to his Formula 3 exploit, so he wasn't kind of the explosion that he was going to be in a couple of years' time. And I remember being at Snetterton, I remember being quicker than him, but only by a tenth or two, but thinking, God, this is going to be great, you know, this, and I'm really excited. And there was a phone call for me, and they said, could Johnny Molan please come to the control tower? And this is, I swear, this is God's truth. And I went up to the control tower thinking, what on earth's going on, you know? And it was Mark Julian again, the team manager for Paul Stewart Racing. And he said, Johnny, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, well, nothing. He said, can you be at Snetterton again tomorrow? And I said, yeah. He said, well, don't get your hopes up. He said, but we'd like to test you again. And Dario's going to be there this time. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, okay. And I remember driving home that night. And obviously, I'd been at Snet the day before, so it was a good one. I'd been in a Vauxhall Lotus the day before. So I was thinking, well, I've got a chance here. Mm-hmm. I rocked up the next day. I can't tell you how nervous I was. And everyone was so friendly. Graham Taylor, who ended up being the godfather to my son, Reese, was Dario's engineer. But he was being super friendly and open and warm. And I basically went out and, you know, Dario was a bit under the weather. I think he had a cold or something. So, you know, whatever reason, I ended up 3/10 quicker than Dario by the end of the day. And I thought, okay, good. And literally, I was driving home, regardless of what was going to happen, feeling very happy, because I felt that this was probably the first time in my life that I'd done, it wasn't really a shootout because it was only me there. Mm. And now looking back, I'm thinking they'd already kind of decided it was mine to lose. Yeah. But at the time I didn't realise that, because again, the naivety of it all, because it was only me there, you know.
But being faster than Dario or Johnny again, did that give you that self-validation that you'd had? You know, was that a turning point that you'd, like when you'd had someone else in your Formula Ford? Was that important to you?
It was very important, because I was obsessed with being quick, and I didn't have the faith in my own abilities then. And so it was really important. And that's why I was driving home happy. Regardless of the outcome, I assumed it would be about money. But I was hoping I'd done myself justice. Well, I knew I'd done myself justice, because the team at the end was saying, great, fantastic. And I remember saying to the team, I'll support Dario. I'll be number two to Dario. I'll do I'll just do whatever it takes to just, you know, just to...
But you didn't have the 70 grand. If they were going to ask you for 70 grand, you didn't have 7 grand. So it wouldn't have made a blind bit of difference how much they asked you for.
No, exactly. And then, I remember I had one of those P3 phones. Do you remember? They're like... not, you know, they were quite slim at the time.
They,
you know, because normally you're walking around with the big old bricks and everything. And I can remember the phone went, I'm driving down, I'm a 1.1 Golf, and the phone goes, and it's Jackie Stewart on my phone.
No way.
Little Johnny Molan, Jackie Stewart, Sir Jackie Stewart, on the phone to me. And I can't actually remember what he said for the first 10, 15 seconds because I was in complete, you know, I can't believe it kind of mode. But the long story, the gist of it was that he'd heard good things about my test. And we're talking an hour after I'd finished testing, maybe less. He'd heard I'd done well in the tests. He wanted me to go to Silverstone that weekend and sit down to talk about doing a potential deal to run the season with Paul Stewart Racing. And I remember saying to him, oh, Jackie, you know, that would be fantastic. And I'll do anything, you know, I'll be a number two to Dario. I'll support Dario. I'll help him win the championship, whatever. Because I felt that very much I was being signed as a number two. And I remember him saying to me, well, from what I've heard of you today, I don't think you should be thinking like that. I think you should be thinking about doing the going for the championship. And which was huge for me. And so he got off the phone. I went home. I'm telling you, I've never been so excited all my life. And I went to Silverstone and I met with Jackie, which just in itself was huge because obviously I'd read about him. Still, you know, one of my favourite drivers was Jackie when I was reading about in the Grand Prix greats and everything. In the bus, and there was a guy called Ian Wallace who was the managing director of Paul Stewart Racing at the time. And I remember Jackie saying to me, what have you got money-wise? And I remember saying, well, I've got a race car. And he said, well, I can remember him saying to me, I can't do his accent, I wish I could. He said, well, that's no good to me. How much is it worth? And I can't remember, 14 grand, 13 grand, something like that. And anyway, he walked out of the bus and he said to Ian, I'll leave you to do a deal. Now, at that point, even in my naivety, bearing in mind I was, what, 24, I was shrewd enough to cotton on to the fact that he'd probably told Ian to do a deal with me no matter what. But it was down to Ian to make sure he did a deal that was financially just about justifiable. So at that point, and I don't really realise how I did this, but Ian said to me, right, we want 75 grand for the season. And I said, Ian, I can't do that. And he said, well, what can you do? And I said, well, I got the car. Let's say that's worth 14 grand. I said, I got about another 10, maybe 15 grand in sponsorship, which was a complete lie. I had nothing. But I figured if I can get signed by Jackie, that will open some doors. Yeah. And I just thought, even doing one race in this team is going to be better than doing a season in my own car. And he said, well, for that, we can give you three races. I said, that's not enough, Ian. That's not enough. I can't do a deal like that. I said, and I don't believe I don't know if I'd have the balls to do that now, but I said to him, I can't do that. I'm going to have to run my own, sort of called his bluff, was ready to walk out.
Yeah.
Even though I wasn't ready to walk out.
Every fibre of your being was going, snatch it, snatch it, snatch it.
And he did a deal with me for six races, which was half the championship, for £25,000. And I ended up doing the whole season for £25,000. In fact, I never found more than about 5-10 grand of sponsorship. And so they were trying to get me to sign a future earnings deal all year. And I have no idea how I got away with not signing it, but I always found a reason not to sign it. And I ended up paying Paul Stewart Racing back for some of the money I owed them for that season for a long, long time over the course of the next 5-6 years. But that is the story of how I got into Vauxhall Lotus. And first race, Dario, to be fair, had a problem. There was problems with the ECU where the vibrations and the pins would break inside and they had to be filled with silicon. But basically, I out-qualified Dario. I think I qualified third my first race. I certainly finished third. I can't remember if third or fourth qualifying, but I certainly finished third. And Dario had problems, to be fair, and finished like seventh or eighth. So I was being taken around. Paul Stewart was there, so Jackie was there. And there I was. I'd finished. And I'd not driven any differently to my car, but their car was just so much better. And there I was on the podium with the top guys running at the front of a top British national championship. And I still couldn't believe it. And if I have one regret looking back, is that I didn't believe in my own abilities more in my early days of single-seaters. And so Jackie said to me, after a year of driving, and obviously I wanted to try and stay with him if I could, he said to me, he said, Johnny, you're actually a very fast driver. He said, but you're also incredibly confused. And I will never forget that. And you know what? He had it spot on, because it wasn't probably until 1997 in the Porsche Cup time that I actually, even going through F3 and stuff like that before then, that I really had faith in my ability to be calm in a race situation and not panic if I wasn't running right at the front immediately.
Looking back now, did you make enough of that opportunity that that you had with Paul Stewart Racing?
Probably not, because I qualified, I'm not going to, I mean, Dario is a fantastic benchmark, everyone knows, you know, and, you know, I out-qualified Dario a few times, you know, it wasn't like he blew me away, but in terms of the championship, he went on to win the championship, and I was nowhere, because I kept on crashing. I can remember I was on the front row with him at Snetterton, and it was a dogleg first, and I went from first, instead of going from first gear to second gear, I went from first to fourth, and got swamped, and then hit by Plato at the first corner, not Jason's fault, but, you know, just the way it works, you know, everyone going into at Brands Hatch, I was on pole, and got the lead at the start, but I got done for a jump start, because I was so nervous and so desperate, I rolled about a foot before the lights went out, so I got that taken away from me, it was all self-destructive. It was all me. No one else was putting the pressure on me. In fact, Paul Stewart would ring me up and try and talk me down and say, you're doing a great job, we're very happy with the way you're doing, because I think they could all see the pace was there, but I didn't have the mental strength to sit on the front row of a grid and think, right, I'm going to get a great start here and I'm going to disappear into the distance. I was sitting there worrying about who was behind me.
How much of that, though, Johnny, again, looking back in 2020 hindsight, is you know, great to be able to do, but how much of that was the fact that you didn't have a lot of race experience? You had not done 10 years of karting. You hadn't been a cadet at 6, 8 years old. How much was that was just the fact that you were still learning and your learning curve was still pretty much vertical, not just with the cars and the technical side of things, but in racecraft and how to behave in a race situation?
Well, that was my fourth year of racing with Paul Stewart Racing and my first ever full season ever. So there was an element of that. I agree with you entirely. There was an element of not having the experience to cope with it. But also, in my experience of the way I am and being really open and honest about my own personality here, I've noticed in the sport, and I've met a lot of the really great drivers, retired and some active, and they all seem to have one thing in common, and that's that they can never accept the blame for themselves for anything. They seem to be very good at in their head genuinely turning it around, and if they make a mistake, it was not their fault. There's a reason why that mistake happened, and it was somebody else's fault. Obviously there are exceptions, but by and large, certain, and I'm not talking necessarily crashing, I'm talking about if they're not quick enough, it's always some other reason. There's always some other reason. Like, you can see the obsession that Ayrton Senna or Alain Prost had with who was getting the engines. So if Alain Prost was out qualified, it wasn't because Senna was quicker, it's because he had a better engine from Honda, you know. Now the real top drivers seem to be able to do that. I wish I could do that, but I think I'm too far the other way. I am too quick sometimes to take the blame myself for situations that actually sometimes aren't my fault. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. And I think I had that in motorsport gives you a mental fragility which works against you in single seaters in particular. Yes. But there are benefits of that in sports cars.
Well, that's interesting. That you should say that. I mean, you did F3. You went through F3. Were you still harbouring some kind of dream to get to Formula One at that point?
I think I did some work with McLaren and got in there, and I
were you making money, by the way, at this point? Was it still your race instructing, your driving instructing, and Brands that was paying your bills?
I was about $250,000 in debt at this point. Oh. I'd set up a company. I was putting things on credit card. I was really struggling. And I went to the Jackie Stewart thing opened my eyes to the fact that, yes, probably Formula One wasn't going to happen. But I still wasn't willing to give up on that dream. And I went to Mark Bailey Racing, and he rang me up out of the blue and asked me to go and drive for him in 95. And we only did 6 or 7 races, and we did it in the national class. Mm-hmm. But a few times we got right up into the top 10. I remember overtaking Elio Castroneves around the outside at Church in Thruxton in the wet and stuff like that. Whenever it rained, we were good. I won four races in out of the 6 or 7 that we did, and set lap records in 3 or 4 of them. Tony Renner, bless him, was one of the guys who was being run with Dick Bennett's of West Surrey Racing. He was a great guy, and so there were some good benchmarks in there. But it was off the back of doing. I won both the races in Formula 3 at Brands Hatch, and I think Ralph Furman Jr. won them overall, and I won the national class in both. And I got a little sidebar in Autosport, sort of Johnny Be Good, whatever, and it was really nice. And the next that on the Friday after the Thursday of that Autosport coming out, I did some instructing for AFN Porsche, and I was going around the Grand Prix circuit at Brands. And at that point, I'd actually made the decision at that end of that year to stop racing because I recognised that even though, you know, Mark Bailey was running me, I think we did that whole year on 55 grand.
Oh.
You know, so he was running...
In F3.
You know, and even then, the budgets, a full season then was like 300, 350,000, which obviously now it's probably double that. But So I recognised this wasn't going to happen because I also began to realise that if you're going to come up and be a Formula One driver, you either need a lot of money behind you or you need to come up like a star. You need to burst on the scene. You need to be like a Lewis Hamilton who win, bang, you're there. And I was coming up like snakes and ladders and it wasn't working. And some of that was down to money and some of that was me occasionally not optimizing my opportunities, but mostly down to a lack of finance and getting into the best car. Because at that point, the only time I'd had the best car was when I was being at Paul Stewart Racing.
Interesting though, Johnny, that, yeah, okay, we know because we know the history, we know what happened next, but you were walking away there. To you, there wasn't any other part of motorsport that you thought you could get yourself into.
It's funny because Matt Griffin, my teammate from last year with the ELMS, he said to me last year, he said, he's very complimentary and said, you know, I'd love to have a career, you know, as long as you've had and do some of the things you've achieved. Do you look back now, you're getting to the end of it and think you've done well? And I said, being brutally honest with you, Matt, I see my career as a failure because I didn't get to where I wanted to get to. I didn't get to F1. I set my marks on being Formula One world champion. And looking back now, that was a mixture of naive and stupid. But I still, that's where I set myself. That's where I wanted to get to. I never even got to race in Formula One. And so I've tested F1 and that's been brilliant, but I've never raced there. And I think now, looking back, I feel that perhaps it's not what I wanted. But at the same time, I'm extremely thankful that I've been one of the few again to actually have a career, a professional career, and be what you could call a professional racing driver. So I don't want this to sound churlish.
No.
But when I look back, I you know, and then again, even in sports cars, you've got, you know, Alan McNish, you know, a good friend of mine. But look at Alan's career and look at my career. So even in sports car terms, okay, yeah, I've won my class in a few things and Sebring and Daytona and stuff like that and race prototypes. And, you know, I've had a few good results on my CV, but I've never, you know, I've not got an Alan McNish level of career. So even in sports car terms, you could look at it and say, well, that's not, you know, it's a bit of a failure, really.
I will say one thing, though. You've got something on your wrist there that McNish hasn't got, and that will be irking him even as we speak about it. And that is the Rolex winner's watch. I do think it's interesting, though, Johnny, that you said, right, that's it. F3, end of the season, I'm done, I'm walking away from motorsport. There was no other motorsport for you, though.
No.
Which I think that's very interesting. And this chance meeting, doing some driving instructing at Brands Hatch, took you in a complete other direction, which you clearly hadn't even considered before.
No, you're right. And I literally was doing the day, sat next to people. And there was a large Texas fellow who I'd got on well with who said to me, would you mind driving me around? And it was a 911 993 turbo, which is one of the cars I would love to actually, I intend to get hold of one of those one day because it's still one of the most beautiful and greatest Porsches ever built. And I said, yeah, I'll take you around. And I took him around the Brands Hatch Grand Prix circuit for two or three laps, loving every minute of it, not really thinking about him sat next to me, just driving it for the sheer fun and hell of driving it. And he was quite quiet, and we came into the pits, and he said, oh, you must love this car. And I said, yeah. He said, how long did it take you to be able to drive it like that? And I said, honestly, this is the first time I've ever driven it. Mm-hmm. And he said, really? I said, yeah, it is that good. Mm-hmm. It is genuinely that good a road car. You can drive it like that immediately. It gives you so much confidence. Mm-hmm. And he got out of the car, and he walked up to the sales manager of AFN Reading. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was AFN Chiswick. And he said, I'm going to buy one of those right now. And he wrote a check there and then for a car. So, of course, at that point, I was like gold dust to the sales manager. So he then started getting people. I don't know how it happened, but I basically ended up spending the rest of the afternoon driving people around. I didn't sit next to anyone, which is great for me because any instructor will tell you sitting next to people, especially in a quick car, is not a lot of fun. At the end of the day, fantastic. Everyone's happy. Go home. The next day, Dave Wilson, who was the sales manager at AFN Chiswick, rings me up and says, would you be interested in coming in and having a chat? Because I've talked to someone. Because I showed him, actually, going back to the autosport, I'd showed him, because he said, because he didn't even know I raced, because most people, you know, if you're doing F3 or something, won't know. So I'd showed him the autosport thing, and he'd been obviously quite impressed by that. So he got me in. I went and met up with him and his manager at Reading and had a chat, and they said, would you be interested in doing it? At that time, Ray Arms had been doing the British Porsche Cup and the AFN car. And they said, would you be interested in, we're thinking of not keeping Ray for the following year, I don't know, for whatever reason. Would you be interested in doing the British Porsche Cup with us? And I'll be honest, at that point, I was thinking, British Porsche Cup? I mean, I was being a complete motorsport snob, you know, and sort of thinking, well, why on earth would I... You know,
this was effectively the forerunner of Carrera Cup GB.
Yes, yeah, the forerunner to that. So, but I just saw it as really clubby. And you know, wrongly, and I've learnt my lesson since, you know, and I just thought, oh, this is crazy. I actually, funny enough, spoke to Fiona because I'd had that moment.
That's where your wife, Fiona, by the way, we should mention. Behind every successful man is an even more successful woman. Oh, we all know that.
She was incredibly, and has been incredibly.
Were you married at that stage, by the way?
So were we talking? Yes. No, we got married. No, I wasn't. Basically, I wasn't married at that point, but we'd been going out with each other a couple of years. And she said to me, well, you know, it's a free, because they weren't going to pay me, but it was a free drive. And I'd never been offered a free drive before. I'd been offered discounted drives. And obviously the Jackie Stewart one was pretty much, I mean, Jackie made the joke that between me and Dario, he made the least money out of any drivers he's ever made in his entire career. And I'm actually one of the big highlights of my career. The only thing Fiona, my wife, has actually ever been really impressed with is I actually got a paragraph in Jackie's autobiography where he mentioned and speaks very nicely about me. But anyway, I'm digressing. So going back to this, I said, right, okay, yeah, I'll do it. And I sort of negotiated with them. They gave me a road car. And I ended up doing the British Porsche Cup in 96 and winning class one of that championship, but not really enjoying it as much as I thought I would, because I drove the car for the first time, and anything that I'd done racing terms went out the window, and everything I'd done in instructing terms and all the cars I'd done in instructing was actually of more relevance to driving that car than any single seater I'd ever driven. And I remember driving it and testing it for the first time and not being particularly quick on the first morning and thinking, I've made the worst mistake of my life here, because I'm getting my ass handed to me by all these other guys out there who no one's ever heard of, who I now realise that you can go into any national, and it's a national championship, you can go into any national championship anywhere, and I guarantee you there'll be two or three guys in that championship who know that championship like the back of their hand, know the cars like the back of their hand, and are going to be very competitive against anyone.
And the other thing, a Porsche, in fairness, a racing Porsche, as well as a road Porsche, a 911 with the engine hanging out over the back, there are a lot of good drivers that never get their heads around that.
There's a black art to driving a Porsche of any description. And I cracked it, but I was a little bit too hard on the gearbox. I wasn't particularly sympathetic. And Mike Jordan from Eurotech, who I also owe an awful lot to, was running me. And we didn't hit it off at the beginning, me and Mike, because I think he was used to telling people the drivers were coming in were slightly older and paying him money. And I was kind of like a factory driver coming in, and I was a young whippersnapper trying to get somewhere. And at that point, nobody had used the British Porsche Cup to get anywhere. And I saw an opportunity here, potentially, because the one thing I had heard of and the one thing that I always thought looked fun to do, even when I was racing single seaters, was Porsche Super Cup, which supported all the Grand Prix.
Right.
And I thought, if I can do this and do well, maybe I can convince AFN, who are effectively Porsche Cars Great Britain, to do Porsche Super Cup. And that year we had a few problems, but Mike and I kind of overcame our difficulties, and I think he understood where I was coming from. We started working really well together sort of from the middle of 96 to the end. And in the end of that year, AFN said, look, we'd like you to come back and do it again in 97. And of course, at this point, I won class one and I won a few races, and there were a few moments going on because people were cheating like mad in that championship. You wouldn't believe, like, the turbos, because obviously it was a mixture of cars, so you had turbos running 5 bar off boost, and people using, you know, one of the people that got caught, and I won't mention his name, but he knows who he is. He was actually using the horn relay to run a different ECU so he could gain power. Very clever. Very clever guys. But again, long story short, came back in 97. This time a lot more committed to the championship, recognising, you know, sort of, I think I took it a bit I did take it a bit for granted the year before, and didn't, I underestimated it for definite. So the following year in 97, we did okay, and I used that. I thought, if I'm going to do this, there's no point in stepping down. You've got to be a big fish in a little pond. If you're going to step down, you need to really star blaze, like we were mentioning earlier. And so I was determined. I never thought I'd win every race. I never thought I'd get that lucky, but I wanted to blitz it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want, and I wasn't taking any prisoners, and I didn't befriend any of the other drivers. I didn't want to be a part of it. I think a lot of people thought, you know, that maybe I was being a bit arrogant or whatever, and I probably was. But for me at that point, this was my last hurrah, you know, and I needed to make this work for me.
Were you getting a salary at that point, or was that still just a free drive and a car, a nice car to drive?
It was just a free car, but I was allowed to keep my I had Goldie, still personal sponsoring me, who helped me in F3, and a record company called Moving Shadow, and I had a chap called Paul Langer, who I still keep in touch with today, who ran West End Vauxhall, who gave me a little bit of money when I was with Jackie to help give Jackie some money, and he was still sponsoring me. So I got to keep all of those personal sponsors. So I was probably making 30 grand maybe. So I was making money for the first time, but I never really thought of myself as a professional driver because I wasn't getting paid to drive.
That was your hard work that brought but that money in.
Exactly.
And in 97, you did blitz the championship. Yeah. You won every round.
Yes.
And we're talking to Johnny Morland, by the way, here on a Radio Le Mans Long Mourn. Did that make the difference to Johnny Morland, racing driver, that you thought it would? First of all, to you, and second of all, to the racing community outside of the Porsche Cup paddock?
I think it made more of a difference to the people outside. I think people already knew I was quick. I think even in F3 and Vauxhall Lotus, I've heard people who don't particularly like me say that, you know, Johnny Morland's quick. You can't deny the speed, but you know he's it's easy to get him to crack under pressure and all, you know, all the things going back to when I was teammates with Dario, and just not recognizing perhaps that, you know, I was mentally fragile for a reason, and I was learning all the time. And 96 was a real learning curve for me. 97 I went there and I was under enormous pressure, and that was the first time I didn't crack, because what people don't remember maybe is that we would pull balls out of a bag. And I put it on pole every time bar one, and we were up against some good people, and every time, or 70% of the time, when I pulled the ball, I'd pull four. So I'm starting fourth on the grid, albeit having qualified on pole, and I was having to come through. So in my head, it was good for me, because in my head, I knew I was quickest, but I knew I had to be patient, and I couldn't just go out there. And everybody, especially as the championship went on, and I was winning every race, every other driver out there was wanting to stop me winning every single race. And they were going to more and more aggressive means to do that. And it was getting to the point where I was getting contact quite a lot and having to keep out of trouble when you're in contact. So you're not going to. And I ended up getting to the end of the year, and I can remember sitting on the grid at Silverstone, and my left leg was shaking so much I could barely keep the clutch down, because obviously the standing starts. And I remember just saying to myself, pull itself together. And I'd been on London weekend television at that point and everything. It was like all really happening. And I won that race and obviously won all 17 out of 17. And I thought, well, that is now a stepping stone for me to really go out there and actually do something good. So I think people, and I won the Gregor Grant Award, the Autosport Gregor, which I'm incredibly proud, because I was actually up for British Club Driver of the Year because of what I've done. So I was nominated for that. And when I didn't win that, I was a bit disappointed. But then I won the Gregor Grant Award. And now, in retrospect, I'm so chuffed that I won the Gregor Grant Award rather than the British Club Driver. Because if you look at the people that have won the Gregor Grant Award, and that's there for the rest of time. And for me, I think that was suddenly, and everyone, all the boys at Autosport, all the journalists there were incredibly supportive and pleased for me. Because I think they could see how hard now I was working, you know, to make this happen for myself.
I think it's interesting that you put so much pressure on yourself there, Johnny, that year in 97. Because, frankly, the championship was won by the time you got to the last race weekend. So it wouldn't have made any difference whether you won that race or not in terms of the championship. But you still had that focus to say, I want to win all of these races. And I wonder how much perhaps some of your still quite short but earlier experiences made you want to deliver that, to finish it off and to finish it off and say, I've done what I said I was going to do?
I think it was more a case of me knowing that I needed to do that to stand out. And if I'd won all the races, but if I'd won all bar one, I would have just been the British Porsche Cup champion again. And that, you know, again, let's not delude ourselves. That's not enough. You have to. And Autosport and Motoring News were talking about how this hasn't been done in the world. Tommy Kendall was doing, you know, hadn't been done in the world that year or before. Tommy Kendall was winning all the races in Trans Am, but then he slipped up about 2 or 3 weeks before my final race. So I thought that maybe I could be the only sort of driver anywhere in the world to be unbeaten at that point. And it's a bit like, funnily enough, I went and did that. I was one of the first people to do it. And Autosport gave me a lot of coverage because of that. And I knew that. And then I think it was only like 2 years later, Andy Prio went and did it in the Renault Spiders. And again, for Andy, was a perfect platform to push himself into where he needed to go.
So that was then the end of 97. You'd set yourself the same almost impossibly high expectation, but you'd fulfilled it. Johnny Morlam is a happy racing driver, but what's his next step? And you said it did make some difference. What doors did that open, and how did that affect you moving forward? And now did you see, hello, sports cars? You mentioned Super Cup. Incredibly difficult to even get into Super Cup. It was in that stage particularly dominated by two or three non-British teams. Not easy to jump into that championship. So what changed? What changed for you looking at 98? And did you feel as though there'd been a change in how your career had been resurrected?
Well, at this point, I knew I was heading for sports cars. And funnily enough, Jason Plato and I had a conversation when we were instructing together before sort of 95, 96. And he'd said, I'm going to go to touring cars. I'm going to give up on the F1 idea. Because he was like me, wanted to get to F1. And he went touring cars, I went sports cars. So at that point, I was giving my full focus the way I had been doing to trying to get to F1 to just becoming a sports car driver. And at the end of 97, obviously done very well, which again, by winning all the races, I kind of knew that put pressure on AFN Porsche. Because if you win all the races, you almost can't come back and do the British Championship again, which is all they'd ever done up until that point. But it involved me going and speaking to people like Mark Bishop, who was the managing director of Porsche Cars Great Britain at the time, and AFN, and saying to them, come on, let's go and do Porsche Super Cup. And initially they didn't want to do it because, and I've been talking to them about it before the end of the year, almost saying, look, if I win every race, can we do this sort of thing? And they'd be saying, well, yeah, but we're a British dealership. Why do we want to go and do something that races all around Europe? And I said, yes, but the Silverstone Grand Prix race on its own will get you more ability to bring sponsors along to and attract people and attention and clients and customers than the whole British Porsche Cup calendar put together.
Nice.
And off the back of that, I literally managed to convince all the directors at Porsche Cars Great Britain that this is the thing we needed to do.
Did it help at all that we're talking about Porsche in Reading, which is, you know, you'd almost throw a cricket ball from where we're sitting here. This is your neck of the woods, your area of the world. You know this part. Did it help at all that you were close to them and you could pop in and keep the pressure on?
Well, at that time, I only just recently moved here, so I don't think that had any real bearing on it. But it certainly didn't hurt that I was around the corner and could go in and see them quite regularly and, you know, always going around buying them a cup of coffee or whatever. And I put an enormous amount of pressure on them to do this. And I think, again, in some ways, I think they realized that maybe it could be good for them, but maybe, I think maybe they felt in a way, and I owe them an awful lot. Maybe they felt that they were helping me in some way by doing this, you know.
How hard was Super Cup? As I said, dominated by mostly German teams in those days. They knew the cars. The cars had been pretty much the same specification for quite a while, so they knew all the ways to, quote-unquote, optimise them. Who ran the car, and how did your Super Cup go?
Well, I did it for 2 years. The first year was Oberbayern, a German team, and that was a real wake-up call for me. Again, I wasn't getting paid. I was just getting my expenses covered and, again, keeping any small personal sponsors I had. And we did okay. I think the best I ever qualified was fifth, and the best I finished was fifth. But there were moments when we were like at Hockenheim, I can remember with the old Hockenheim with the chicanes, where I really just didn't get my head around it. And you needed a slipstream to get a good time there. And unfortunately, no one wanted to slipstream with me because I was the only British driver in it. It was very much a German. I can remember Alfred Heger hitting me at Imola when I was like seventh, going to the last corner, hitting me, winding me off, and staying wheel spinning into me in the wall because I'd been blocking him for like two, three laps, desperate to try and keep the place. And I remember getting out of the car and running over to me and pointing at me and going, "The war is over. The war is over." This is Alfred Heger, you know, the famous German driver. And I'm just thinking, Jesus, you know. And the person that really took care of me that first year was Herbie Blash, mm-hmm. because he was the clerk of the course for the Porsche Super Cup. And I was getting hit left, right, and center. And initially, I was getting beaten up. And then I basically started giving as good as I got. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where I was maybe giving too much back because mm-hmm. I was feeling, you know, I had a mm-hmm. chip on my shoulder about it all. So that affected me a lot that year. And we didn't finish a lot of races, some through my own fault and some through other people just wiping me out. But in 99, we did it again. And this time, a guy called Ken McCulloch came in who owned the Malmaison Hotel, who also mm-hmm. at the time owned the Columbus Hotel in Monaco. And he came on as a main sponsor, and he went to do a thing called Parabolica, to the Parabolica McCulloch team. Mm-hmm. And Parabolica was owned by David Morrison. And that was the first time in 99 when I had a British team and a British teammate. Initially, it was Oliver Gavin, which mm-hmm. was, for me was weird because... And I like Ollie, but I don't think he likes me much for some reason. I think based probably on the fact that when we were teammates in Porsche Super Cup... You know, I was still very much single-seater mentality at that point. Mm. My teammate's my biggest enemy. And I think he was kind of the same. And for him, it was a difficult one because at that point, okay, I'd done well in the British Porsche Cup. But I can remember Oliver Gavin doing, you know, winning in F3 mm-hmm. when I was running in the national class. Mm-hmm. So I think he saw me as just somebody that was beneath him in terms of talent and ability. And obviously, if that person then gets close to him or let alone out-qualifies him, which is what happened in Melbourne... it doesn't look good for him, and mm-hmm. I don't think he liked that, which I can completely relate to. And then
he'd be knocking on the door of F1 as well. Let's
absolutely.
Not forget.
I mean, Ollie Gavin's quality driver, yes. quality driver. So for me, again, and a great benchmark to have. And at that point, I'm still feeling I need to prove myself here. I'm still thinking, you know what? I'm not proving to the world. Yes, at national level, I'm good enough. Am I good enough at international level? Whereas I don't think Ollie needed to prove that, whereas I did. So I felt I had a lot to prove, and I think probably that made. Maybe made me perhaps not as friendly a teammate as I could have been. And I do have regrets about some of that. But I was so blinkered in what I was trying to achieve that I felt that if I didn't just keep that real narrow window and look where I was headed to, if I looked off at the side at any point, I might fall off the train that I was on, you know. So, and then we did quite well that year. We qualified, finished in third in Melbourne and then qualified in the front row at Imola. We were quick all year. And then Ollie Gavin went off and did, with Paul Stoddart, did 3,000. Yep. After two or three races, he left. And I got Gary Ailes in. And unfortunately, Gary wasn't really quick enough. So they got rid of Gary, brought Tim Harvey in. Now, mm-hmm. Tim Harvey taught me a lot about mental games. My God, there is a chap who plays the mental game with his teammate all the time, constantly. And again, that toughened me up because there were little chinks in my armour still that he welded up for me because I need to. And fortunately for me, apart from one occasion at Hockenheim, I beat him every race. And so it was all looking really positive. And in 99, at the beginning of 99, I got a phone call. And again, this is through Alan McNish. This came about from a guy called Tony Callas, who asked me if I'd be interested in doing Daytona. And it was between me and Stefan Ortelli and somebody else. And I said yes, and he flew me out. It's the first time anyone's ever sent me a ticket, and flew me out to LA, and we went and tested at Willow Springs. It's the first time I've ever driven on a track in America was Willow Springs in a GT2 Porsche, and it went quite well. And he asked me to do the race, to do Daytona, and we finished second in GT at Daytona and ninth overall, and I did it for free. Again, mm-hmm. he paid my expenses, and at the end of that, they won quite a lot of prize money, mm-hmm. and he rang me up, and he said, "I'm going to give you $3,000 prize money, and by the way, can you do all these races?" And it was a combination of the ALMS and the USRRC mm-hmm. Championship, which was before the preempt to Grand Am. Yep. And there was about 11 races. And I can remember this moment like it was 2 minutes ago. I wasn't feeling very well. I'd been in bed, but he'd rung me and I got the flu, so I wasn't quite as straight in the head. And I remember him saying to me, "And how much money are we talking?" And for a split second, I thought he meant, "How much money can I bring?" Ha! And then I suddenly realized he was saying to me, "How much money would you want to do these races?"
Wow.
And that, at the beginning of 99, was my epiphany, because at that point, and he only paid me, I think, $3,000 for the short ones and $5,000 for the long ones. But for me, I felt like a millionaire, because I was actually getting, for the first time ever, I'd become a paid professional racing driver.
That year, of course, was the start of the American Le Mans series. Yeah. We'd had Petit Le Mans in 98. It was the start of my American odyssey, yeah, and the start of yours as well, ironically. And we, you know, clearly we went through that together,
yeah,
hardly missing any of the races. And I don't think any of us thought, even, well, certainly not a Petit in 98, but even through 99, what the American Le Mans series was going to be. But it became very quickly in any terms, never mind motor racing terms, it was the World Championship, wasn't it?
By 2000, I mean, 99 was great, mm-hmm, and I couldn't do all the races in 99, unfortunately, because I was doing Porsche Super Cup, so I could only do 5 or 6 of the 10 that he wanted me to do. But I soon realised, and I was there for the first official 1999 Sebring, ALMS Sebring, and we soon realised this was amazing, and I loved racing in America, mm-hmm, absolutely loved it. And the thing was there, I had burst on the scene there, because yeah, it was like, who's this guy, Johnny Molan? We came in at the end of 99. We won with the GT2, with the beating the sort of GT3 RS, mm, you know, with Dirk Müller in it and everything, mm, else. The last time that that car won a race. So I was winning in ALMS, and suddenly people wanted to talk to me about driving for them. And the thing I love about America is, and it maybe has changed over the years, but I think it's still there, is that if a driver comes and drives for you, the team accept that they are going to have to pay you, mm-hmm, most of them. Mm-hmm. It's not a case of how much money can you bring, like in Europe. And I think it was a bit like what Japan was like, mm, you know, before. And even that's changed a little bit in Japan. But basically, teams would talk to me and say, right, okay, we want you to come and drive for us. And that was the first time I really felt like I'd arrived, and yeah, I was a professional driver, and there were people, you know, I had more than one opportunity in terms of drives, and it was really working out well. And the American Le Mans series then flourished.
Yeah.
And I stayed in it on and off pretty much the entire time, for its entire existence. And I said this to Scott Atherton and Don Panos when it finished. I went up and shook their hands and thanked them, and I said, without the American Le Mans series, I probably wouldn't have had the professional career that I've had, because I would say 75% of my professional career was the American Le Mans series.
I remember that last turbocharged Porsche win. It, yes, was at Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca, if, yep, I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
And we didn't know then that that was the end of an era.
No.
But the car was, I mean, it wasn't in its first flush of youth then, but that was a fabulous race for all kinds of different reasons. But you managed to take the momentum on. The other thing about America, not just about the paying, what I liked about America was I was seeing people who were looking at drivers and saying, yeah, well, I know he's 8th, but look at the piece of nonsense, yeah, he's driving in.
Yeah.
He's getting more out of the car than the results would suggest. It was results driven, but not completely results driven.
America's very different. Like, I'll give you an example. You can see an IndyCar driver coming out of the pits in America, and you've got commentators on it. You've got American commentators, and you've got European commentators. Mm-hmm. And you'll hear the driver in the pits, and you'll hear the engineer say to him, you've got new tyres on, got cold tyres, careful leaving the pits. Mm-hmm. And he goes out, and he spins. Mm-hmm. And he spins across the track and hits the wall. Mm-hmm. And you hear the commentators, the European commentators saying, basically, what an idiot. He's gone out. They told him he had cold, mm-hmm, tyres on, and, mm-hmm, he still lost it and went across and hit the wall. Mm-hmm. The American commentators will say, ladies and gentlemen, this is how you see how hard a job it is for these guys, for these drivers out there, of this level and this talent, that he knew he had cold tyres on, mm-hmm, but it still managed to get away from him, mm-hmm, and he still had an incident. Mm-hmm. So it just shows you how hard, mm-hmm, it is for these, mm-hmm, guys out there. Different. Glass half empty, glass half full.
Yeah.
And America, I can imagine, was like, for me, and it is changing, but, mm-hmm, not as quickly as it has in Europe. But I can imagine that America, all the years I raced there from 99 all the way through until last Petit Le Mans last, mm, year, 2013, was a bit like racing in Formula One in the terms of the camaraderie between, yeah, the teams and the drivers and everything else, maybe in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that.
And I loved every minute of it. And what I didn't realise is how many drivers now, like Matt Griffin and people like that, are hankering to come out and race in America. And unfortunately for them, they've missed it.
Yeah.
Because Tudor and Grand Am and everything else, it's not the same
no.
as it was. It was already changing even towards the end yes. of the LMS.
Yeah, last 4 or 5 years.
I mean, for me, the peak was like 2000 yeah. to sort of like 2008, 2009, mm-hmm. you know, and you had all the top manufacturers in every class.
Well, like I said, it was a world championship. It was a world championship in everything but name.
Well, this is the thing. Everyone's saying to Alan, what's it feel like to be a world champion? But he's been a world champion before mm. in the American Le Mans series. But yes, I guess when you're in an FIA-sanctioned world championship, then you can call yourself an officially a world championship. But I agree with you. The American Le Mans series, for me, especially in GT, yeah. has been, ever since 2000, 2001, has been the championship to race in anywhere in the world until this year, probably. This year, even in GT, it's still strong, but maybe WEC, you could say, is equally as strong.
Golden years. Oh. A golden era for sports car racing. I feel privileged to have been a part of it. I can't quite remember Group C, and I wasn't into it as much then, and everybody of a certain age, my age normally, talks about that, but I was late into sports cars. I'm sorry, I brought a note. But I feel privileged to have been a part of the American Le Mans series and missed a handful of races. Is it wrong to ask you, can you pick out a few highlights of those years?
Well, I agree with you about the LMS, and I think American Le Mans series 20, 30 years from now will be regarded as a golden era of sports cars, and people will look back and they'll say, like you say, it's a privilege to have been a part of it. And for me, the highlights obviously were my first really getting paid proper money in 2000 with Rowan Skay and the Australian GT team. And that was the first time I can remember David Murray was my teammate with Callas, and I was still only getting 5,000 a race or whatever. And I can remember he told me, I've got a deal with this new guy and he's paying me a lot of money. And it was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to Fiona, my wife, oh God, wouldn't it be nice at the end of 99 thinking, why can't I get drives like that? Because I've been quicker than David the year before. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly realised, you know, this could happen. And I ended up being teammates with David again with Rowan Skay, with Skay Racing. And that was the first year I got paid good money. So that probably was one of the highlights just from a personal level. From a sporting side, I have to say probably 1999, winning with David against Dirk Müller and getting the track record there. And that for me was important. And this isn't just ego talking. It's important because people at that point didn't really know me and it was important to establish myself. And then also my first... the first time we did first and second in Mossport for Ferrari with the Ricci, that was a highlight. The Celine years for me were a real highlight. Hard. And obviously you and hard I worked hard for the 2001 Le Mans, but the Le Mans 24 hours. But they were very hard. But for me, those 2-3 years in the Celine were great years, taking the fight to the Corvettes and never quite managing it. At Mossport, we really could have won it at Mossport. Terry Borchella led it from pole. I led it when I got in, and literally we came in to take a splash of fuel, and we took 3 seconds longer than we should have done, and we went from first to third.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how competitive it was in those days.
That's how competitive it was. And then I guess more recently, driving my first time in an LMP1 in the American Le Mans series was fantastic in the Petit Le Mans with Stephanie Hansen and Kurosawa finishing in second place to the Audi of Alan and Dindo Capello. Overall, so that was a great highlight.
That was no bad result, was it?
No, that was fantastic. And that got me into LMP1 as well. So, because up until then, I'd been very much a GT driver because that's where the opportunities would be. And at that point, then people were actually considering me for LMP stuff as well, which was very useful. The LMPC pole that I got in Laguna Seca again, which still stands because of the way the rules have gone. So, it looks like I'm going to hold that LMP track record forever. So, I'm very pleased with that. And then, probably, even though I wasn't in the car at the time, for me, and I think it's got voted one of the highlights of the American Le Mans series, was Jamie Mello and that last lap at Sebring in 07, which won him, myself and Mika Salo the 2007 Sebring GT race. And that, to me, standing on the pit wall with Mika next to me, not knowing what was going on, whether we'd kept it, hadn't kept it, and the subsequent fallout of that, for me, was actually...
And there was probably some bloke who's not too far away with your head exploding on the PA.
Yes. I remember you.
What's happening?
To be honest, I'm not just saying this because you were sat next, you're sat next to me. But for me, you commentating and Radio Le Mans for me is synonymous with the American Le Mans series, which is why latterly, towards the end of it, I couldn't understand why they couldn't see what was going wrong with it. But to be honest with you, John, your voice has been an integral part of my sports car career, whether it's Le Mans, American Le Mans Series, WEC now, because obviously we've gone on to win the European Le Mans Series last year with Ram and everything else. So we've come through it almost together in a way.
I can't finish off this, and we have got to finish it off at some stage, otherwise I will run out of, I was going to say tape, I'll run out of didge, whatever it is. But we've got to talk about Le Mans, because you immediately understood about the passion, the history, the importance of Le Mans. Some people don't. And, you know, I have a laugh with some drivers who go, yeah, it's not a hard track to drive. Can't be that hard to learn. You know, how hard can it be? They don't get it in the way that other people do. And I feel sorry for them if they don't, because it isn't just another motor race. It shouldn't just be another motor race. Of course, I'm bound to say that. But the emotion, the history, all of that, you tapped into that straight away. You understood about that straight away, didn't you?
I did, and a part of that was because I went down to, in 1998, I went down to the test days with Alan McNish when he was the factory Porsche driver, and I stood in the back of the Porsche garage and watched how important it was to everybody, Herbert Amphra, who was head of motorsport at the time at Porsche, and all the drivers, and Yannick Dalmas, and I watched how important it was just at the pre-qualifying, those are the pre-qualifying days, for them to be quickest, and then how it made the newspapers the next day and all the rest of it, and Alan being fastest, and I suddenly thought, wow, this is a big deal. This is a really big deal. And then when I went there and did it for myself and was fortunate enough to get on the podium and stand there in front of that sea of people and think, wow, I mean, this is something else, and do the driver parade where you feel like a rock star, but you could be a chimpanzee on the back of one of those cars and you'd still be made to feel like a rock star. And I do get it, and I say this and I mean it, in terms of it's humbling to be there, because you feel privileged. This will be my 10th this year, and you feel privileged to be a part of it, whether you're a spectator, a driver, a mechanic, a commentator, an engineer, a press officer, whatever. It doesn't matter, a marshal. You are there. You are part of history being made.
Agreed.
And Christian Fittipaldi said to me when I drove with him in 06 in the Saline, he's done Indy 500, he's done F1, he's done everything, he's done the Monaco Grand Prix, and he said to me when we were doing the driver parade, he said, I've done all of these things, including the Indy 500, and he said, I have never experienced anything quite like this. And National Geographic voted it, didn't they? Number one sporting event anywhere in the world out of any of them.
Yeah.
Single sporting event.
Not just motor racing. European Le Mans Series Championship last year with Ram, with Matt Griffin in the Ferrari. You've both moved up into WEC this year. That's recent history. Congratulations on that. It's not that I don't want to dwell on it, but you have said you're coming to the end of your career within this interview. I would argue with you. I think you've got a few years left and you're yet young man. And I can say that from a position of greater vintage. But you got into broadcasting quite some time ago. How did that start? And was that a part of just the driving, or was that thinking further ahead? Was that Johnny Morlam thinking, I need to have something to do when I don't drive anymore?
I think it was more just going back to what I said to you earlier on in the interview about being at university and being able to stand up and talk and deliver dissertations, and how that helped me find sponsorship. And I remember when I went to race with Jackie and Paul Stewart Racing, excuse me, that was the first time I'd actually had to go and do anything other than just turn up and drive. I had to do PR stuff and talk to the sponsors and all the rest of it. And I think Jackie cottoned on very quickly that I was quite good at that. And so he used me. I mean, Dario has become brilliant at it, but at that time, Dario was very tongue-tied in that sort of way, you know, and quite shy. And okay, he's 3-4 years younger than me, but it was still difficult for him, whereas I've like took to it like a duck to water. And I think it's just something that came, anyone listening to this interview will know, just I talk for Britain, you know. So I think it was just something that came very easily to me. And I think other people, and Andrew Marriott, who's been a real, like, almost surrogate father to me over the years and really helped me. He, right back at the beginning in 98, him and Roger Moody put together a Sky Sports program that followed me and has followed me ever since then. So 15, 16 years of having a program on Sky Sports, which has evolved in name from Molam's World Travels, Molam's Racing Travels, whatever. But from doing a lot of TV on that program, and off the back of that, and them seeing me and moving in the circles where people say, oh, well, would you like to come in and be a pundit for this or a pundit for that? And then I've did Sky TV, the IndyCar stuff with Keith Ewan, for a long time, and it's just sort of evolved, really. I've always been okay when someone shoves a camera in my face and a microphone, unless it's a really bad time. I've always been reasonably good at coming up with a soundbite, and it's something genuinely that I would be very interested in getting into in the presenting side, because I'm under no illusions. It's very easy to sit there as a pundit and just answer questions when you're spoken to, and it's a big difference to being sat there as the person in the middle holding it all together, as you'll well know, John, because obviously you're an extremely experienced broadcaster, and have someone screaming in your ear. And at the same time, you've got one question and the person's not finished answering it, and you're being told you've got to go to break in 4 seconds or whatever. So I'm under no illusions. I know the talent. I always wore an earpiece when I did the IndyCar stuff, to be able to listen in, even though it didn't really affect me, but just to get used to having people chatting in your ear whilst I'm talking. And it's something in the future when I do stop. And I do feel... I feel I'm driving as well as I ever have done. I think this year is going to be a tough year because for a variety of reasons, with after what happened last year, with this year, we're running obviously in the 12 spec with our car. I think Le Mans will be a tough one. I'm not saying we can't win it, but I think a lot of the reasons I went into the Pro-Am car, as I think I've said to you on previous interviews, were to win Le Mans. I want to win my class at Le Mans. It's the one big thing I feel in my career I've not managed to achieve. Obviously, I'd love to have won Le Mans overall, but there's very limited opportunities to do that, unless you're an ex-F1 driver or LMP factory driver. But I'd like to win my class at Le Mans. I pretty much won every other major sports car race, at least in class or overall. So that's one I'd like to do. And I think when I went into the Pro-Am car and wanted and requested with Dan at Ram Racing to do that, since then, a lot of things have changed in the rules, in the technical side on the car, the drivers, everything. So I think some of the reasons I wanted to go in there maybe have been stripped away a little bit, but I'm still very excited that we can hopefully, because Le Mans is Le Mans, so I'm hoping we can get a good result there and do really well. And I feel, like you were just saying about driving, I feel like I'm driving as well now as I ever have. But the problem I've got is that when you don't do well, at the sort of stage of my career that you are now, a lot of people look at that and see that as, right, he's lost it.
They don't see it as a single event. Exactly. They see it as, oh, that's the end.
Yeah, I think when you're 28, 29 and you've proven your speed, people aren't, oh, we kind of just lost it. When you get a little bit older, you know, I remember Alan being questioned when he was having a few shunts at Le Mans and had his contact. He had a few, and Alan never had contact. I mean, he was renowned in traffic for being one of the best in the business.
Outstanding.
I remember Ralph Yuttner saying that to me, that he's never seen anyone better in traffic than Alan in terms of not losing time but not hitting people. And then he went through a period of time where he hit people and people started questioning, is it the end for Alan? You know, they wouldn't have questioned him if he was 31.
No, exactly.
They were questioning him because it was 42. And it came to me a little bit in Dubai this year. I had contact now with the best will in the world. The team had just told me to push, and I knew I had to push. But an example of that is I'd still probably dive down the inside of that car in Dubai if I had to do it today, obviously not knowing if I was going to have contact, because that was a decision I had to take at that time.
Yeah.
So some of it is a bit of bad luck that sometimes creeps in, and you don't realise maybe how lucky you've been, because I don't normally have contact with anyone, as you know. So, and off the back of that, people sort of, I was quite shocked that a lot of people thought, well, maybe Johnny's losing it, you know. So I think, going back to your thing about saying you've got a few years left in you, yeah, I think in terms of my driving ability, I think I'm driving as well as I ever have. But in terms of people's perception, maybe that isn't the same. And unfortunately, this business relies 100% on perception.
Well, yes, perception is reality as far as the business is concerned. Would you consider going into team management, running a team? You've seen teams being run well. You've seen teams being run badly. You've seen teams... in between, you've clearly got a skill to talk to people, to raise money as you had to do in your early career. And from my point of view, as somebody who's inside the sport, I believe you'd have a lot to give to up-and-coming drivers in any part of the sport, but particularly in endurance racing. Is it something you've considered?
Not particularly in terms of team management. Something that actually came very close to at Lotus when I was in the factory team and at Lotus, because I thought the Lotus would be my ticket to the end, because they promised me LMP2 and then LMP1. The LMP2 was guaranteed. The LMP1, they said, we'll see how far down the road we are and where you're at by the time we get there, because that was going to be like a 15-16 kind of thing. And I thought, well, I'll race with Lotus, do well with Lotus, and I'll be ambassador for Lotus, a bit like Alan's doing with Audi, you know. And they were talking to me about potentially doing something on the commercial director side for motorsport, because that's something I do feel I am quite good at, is is not just finding the sponsorship, but also learning how to keep the sponsorship, which is quite important. I'm quite proud that I've had a few personal sponsors now over the years, and some of them I've had for 10, 12 years. I've kept year in, year out. And so that was something that probably appeals to me more. But I, if I had to say now, especially having just recently done the Indy 500 with BT Sport, I would say that there is something about live television, and you'll know this. I need something that gets the old adrenaline juices flowing. And if it's not going to be actual driving, then I need something that's a little bit dangerous that you can really mess up, that you can really mess up on. Now, of course, if you mess up in a studio, you don't hurt yourself, but you still look like a complete fool. And that gives you that excitement. So I think that probably if someone said to me right now, walked in and said, right, Johnny, you can do whatever you want now, just, you know, give wave a magic wand, I'd say I'd like to get into a bit of presenting and broadcasting. But that's not to say that I wouldn't work as a consultant with a team. And certainly in the early days, Ram Racing were very, I mean, I've had quite a lot of input into Ram Racing in the early days as to how it was coming up, and that, you know, and Dan's, you know, used me as a sounding board on occasion. And who knows with the longevity of that, obviously I'm not quite sure how that's all going to work out in the long term, but there may be something in Ram Racing that I could do to help them commercially.
Well, there's also a job for you as a football commentator, famously, you and I doing that at Le Mans a few years ago.
Are we going to do that again this year?
We might have to. It's World Cup, yeah. Johnny, don't hang up the helmet and driving boots just yet. You have provided us with great entertainment. You've always been an absolute gentleman when we've stuck microphones underneath your nose, not just me, but our pit lane team, even under some very stressful situations. Thank you very much for the time that you've spent with us here on this Radio Le Mans Long One.
Thank you very much, John. It's been actually incredibly cathartic to talk about.
I'll send you the invoice.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemans.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.